My presentation this morning is going to be slightly different than what we had last evening. I consider it mostly a review of basic principles that we've all learned, or certainly at least touched upon while we were in seminary formation. But my hope is that our time together will help us to understand why some of these principles are true and at work, and how we can articulate those principles when dealing with patients and families that are nearing the end of life or having difficulties making tough decisions with regard to their medical care. So, we're going to be speaking briefly. Here's an outline about an introduction. After this introduction on the inalienable dignity of life, talk a little bit about moral choices and double effect. Obligatory and optional treatment, which is a moral decision and not a medical one. Euthanasia, what it is, and assisted suicide, which is, of course, the big issue of the day. We'll be talking about that towards the end of my presentation. How that is distinguished from allowing a person to die from a pathology or from their illness. And, of course, the primacy that we give to care, especially with nutrition and hydration. And then I will close my presentation by turning to some secular voices about the quality of life. This is, I think, the issue that we're going to be fighting and we're going to be facing for the foreseeable future. And then I'll offer some concluding thoughts on futility and hope. St. John Paul II famously said in Evangelium Vitae, that man is called to a fullness of life which far exceeds the dimensions of his earthly existence because it consists in sharing the very life of God. The loftiness of this supernatural vocation reveals the greatness and the inestimable value of human life, even in its temporal phase. It's important to say that we believe that the dignity of human life is intrinsic and inalienable to every member of the human species, regardless of race, regardless of creed, regardless especially of ability or disability. Every person has an intrinsic dignity that neither grows nor lessens, because every person is made in the image of God, and every person is called to life with God. So it doesn't depend on sex, it doesn't depend on creed, ability, talent, state of life. It is what it is. It's beautiful. The difficulty we run into is when people want to claim that the dignity of life is somehow attached to these other qualities, such as achievement, accomplishment, self-manifestation, communication, so that what is being valued there is not the life that manifest itself, the person who communicates himself or herself. What's being valued there is simply the ability. And so the person and the person's life is really, if we can speak philosophically, seen only as a vessel or a container for these goods. Right? That says nothing about the person. It says more about what they do rather than who they are. So whether a child is born with spina bifida, or with a mitochondrial depletion syndrome and severe brain damage, or anencephaly without even a brain, a member of the human species has an intrinsic dignity. It becomes difficult in a culture without God, in which God has sort of been sidelined, to have those arguments and those discussions. Living in Washington, D.C., as many of the Dominicans here do, and certainly where we all studied at the Dominican House of Studies, we find how difficult it is to even talk about the dignity of life with those who espouse a secular worldview, precisely because there is no longer even a sense of solidarity on the level of the human species, right? That somehow it's unique to be human and therefore we should take care of one another. We'll talk more about that in a minute. And this is why, because of this inalienable dignity, that no one can directly destroy an innocent human being. As I say, the problem we're running into in a culture that is generally faithless is that human dignity is no longer grounded in the divine. Even solidarity with fellow members of the species is no longer enough to secure the dignity of all. Perhaps it never was without God as a grounding of one's worldview. But especially now, as we're surrounded by an increasing advocacy for animal rights, I would say also, not to be flip, but what I can only call the humanization of pets. You know, when people start to refer to their pets as their children, I mean, that is insulting to human children. It dehumanizes human children. Right? It makes real children less valuable than pets, because a pet never talks back, in theory, right? Although it might have an accident here and there. So it's an insistence on qualities that secure dignity. So we're in this for the long haul. So that's why it's important for us as priests, when we're talking to our people and talking to clinicians, to understand very clearly the distinctions that we want to make with regard to moral choices, and to understand how our people hear our words, how we communicate to them, but also to understand how clinicians, how doctors and nurses hear our words, and how they interpret what we say. So once again, just to review, we begin our march by looking at a single moral choice, what the Catholic tradition refers to as the sources of morality, that the morality of human acts depends on the object chosen, the end in view of the intention, and the circumstance of the action. So the intention is to tend towards something that is attractive, a goal that we want. So just I realize this is Moral Theology 101, but we'll get a little bit more complicated here in a minute. But just to remember that in every choice, and for St. Thomas, pretty much every choice that we are master of is a moral choice. Even the choice to choose coffee over tea, it is a moral choice in some way. So we have something that's attractive to us, a goal in mind. Perhaps it's having breakfast. Perhaps it's taking a nap, just to use the banal. And so we intend that. So the intention is to direct us to a goal that is attractive. It remains a mere idea, a mere thought, until it commands or moves the powers of the soul to act by choosing some activity. So when we speak about the object chosen, and there's tons of ink spilled on this word, object, and so we can refer you to other literature on this, and there's opposing viewpoints on what it means. But here, we're simply going to say that when we talk about the object, we're talking about an activity. And by activity, we don't necessarily mean an external activity. Sometimes it's an omission. Sometimes it's a lack of activity. Sometimes it's merely internal. It seems attractive for you right now, perhaps, to zone out of my talk, right? So your activity might be, your intention to zone out, your activity might be to daydream. I can't see that. I can probably see some nonverbals that would suggest it, but I can't see it, right? It's not a physical or visible activity. So we choose certain activities to get us to the goal that is attractive. And the point of the Catechism and the point of Veritatis Splendor, written by St. John Paul II, is that all activities have a certain object or purpose in and of themselves, even if we cannot yet identify the intention of the agent. If you are walking, I know you're trying to get somewhere, even if I don't know the intention of where you're trying to get to. Right? So activities have their own purpose. It's why we choose some activities to reach some goals and some intentions. There's a rational link, a reasonable link to see how this activity will get me to this goal. For St. Thomas, for action to be moral, for a choice to be morally good, all of this has to be good. My intention has to be good. The activity has to be good. The activity has to reasonably and rationally line up to my goal. If at breakfast you see me and you come to me and I've got my bowl in front of me, I've poured the milk, I've got the spoon, and you approach me and you see that my bowl is not filled with cereal, but it's filled, in fact, with iron carpet tacks, and you say to me, Father, why are you eating iron carpet tacks? And I tell you, well, my doctor says I need more iron in my diet, right? That is not a good activity, because the activity of eating iron carpet tacks is not a rational means to achieve my goal of getting iron in my diet. It's going to kill me. I hope you'll stop me. So if an activity is not able to get me to my goal, it is not that there's no relationship rationally between the intention, the activity, and the end. And importantly, just to reaffirm this, in the Catholic moral tradition, reaffirmed by John Paul II in Veritatis Splendor, there are some activities, some objects that are intrinsically evil. They can never line up with a good intention. They can never bring a person closer to God. And he says they, in fact, make the agents, they do more harm to the agent than they do to the victim. The man who intends or chooses the activity of torture for the intention of gaining information to save his country becomes a torturer. He becomes a man who easily pulls fingernails out. And while that might be painful to the victim, it does something worse to the man. Sometimes, when we talk about our moral choices, we can have a deeper intention that requires and governs, if you will, a whole series of actions. And each of those actions, while they might be governed by a deeper intention for a long-term goal, each of those actions are still moral choices. And you know, our tradition says that each of those actions, any single one of them, if it is a mortal sin, you're condemned. You must go to confession to be absolved. So sometimes we can have a deeper intention that requires other actions or a series of actions with their own proximate intentions, their own proximate goals. So, the deeper intention for some further end, right? But we can't get to that further end from here, so we make a series of choices. We have a deeper intention, then we have a proximate intention for a choice that gets us to a proximate end that becomes itself then the means to this further goal. St. Thomas uses the example of the man who steals in order to commit adultery. All right? Now, I have to tell you, it wasn't until I started teaching at Providence College when I was first ordained that I didn't really quite understand how stealing helps you to commit adultery. But the seniors of Providence College did, so I don't think they're thieves. I don't think they committed adultery, but they had all sorts of creative options. So just to say, just to say the deeper intention here is to commit adultery. So you steal, taking the money, I have the money, you know, becomes the means then to committing adultery. For St. Thomas, the man who steals in order to commit adultery, to commit adultery is the deeper intention. He says the man is more of an adulterer than a thief because it's deeper, right? Robin Hood is another example. Robin Hood steals in order to give money to the poor, right? So his deeper intention is to give money to the poor. So he's very compassionate. He's a philanthropist for Robin Hood. But the problem is he's also a thief, you see. So when we talk about this, well, I mean, this is just for us to get our sort of minds around it, that when we have our intentions, and we all have deep intentions, our deepest intention, you might say, is obviously to be united with God. In some ways that characterizes us. But we're also characterized by those successive intentions that govern our actions, one after the other. So Robin Hood, more compassionate, more of a philanthropist, more charitable than he is a thief, but he's still a thief. The man who is more of an adulterer than a thief, but he's still an adulterer. He's still a thief. And we turn to another point in moral theology, simply to say, when we're looking at these choices, this further end does not justify everything that goes on up here. The ends don't justify the means. So, when we begin to talk about euthanasia, the deeper end of compassion to eliminate suffering does not justify the proximate intention of killing someone to eliminate the suffering. Now let's turn to another quick point in moral theology. This is just a quick review, so I won't spend much time on it. But you can find this in the Secunda Secundae, the second part of the second part of the Summa, question 64, article 7. St. Thomas says, when we talk about self-defense, we can foresee three possible outcomes. The first is that killing the offensor, the aggressor, is accidental and unforeseen. The second is that killing is chosen as a means for self-defense. Right? So the intention is self-defense. And then the third is to intend to kill the aggressor. For St. Thomas, only these first two are moral. You cannot intend to kill, certainly as a private citizen. Right? Now, you can think in the heat of the moment who's thinking what here, but we'll talk about that after the fact. But the point is you can't use self-defense as a justification to intend to kill somebody. You have to always be intending self-defense. The killing can be accidental, but you can actually kill as a means to defend yourself if needed. There's proportionality involved here. I mean, the guy's coming at you with a butter knife, you probably shouldn't pull out your gun. You know? So just to continue on this briefly, and we'll move forward, to say that private citizens are not and cannot intend to kill for St. Thomas. He has a different calculus, if you will, different evaluation of what the state can do. Think of the death penalty, for instance, or just war. And that the chosen activity, always remember the chosen activity has to be in line with the intention. So that what I'm doing has to have a rational connection with my intention for the goal. Right? That's reasonable and proportionate. He has this whole business that, for instance, fornication and adultery is not in line with self-defense. It doesn't immediately defend you to commit adultery or fornication. This is a common case study in some moral theology textbooks about the woman who might sleep with the guard at the jail to help her escape certain death. All right. Okay. In that instance, what you have is a series of actions. Her intention is to get out of jail. You can't say that committing adultery is how she's defending herself, right? It's a series of actions with a deeper intention of trying to get out of jail, trying to be free. Finally, the third point, just to talk about this, is the principle of double effect. The activity must be, in a principle of double effect, the activity itself, remember, must be either morally good or morally neutral. The activity has two effects, one good and one evil. You must intend the good effect, but not the evil effect, even though you can foresee the evil effect. When you talk about this with the people of God, this is often a hang-up. How can you foresee something but not intend it? So you really have to work to help them understand that we can foresee all sorts of things that might happen because of our choices and not intend those things. What is protecting the intention, however, in double effect, is precisely that the good effect flows from the activity itself and not from the evil effect. It flows from the activity itself and not from the evil effect. The evil effect does not outweigh the good effect. It's merely tolerated. The classic example would be the group of rock climbers all tied off together. The last one falls off the cliff. He's dangling, pulling everyone down, and one of the rock climbers cuts the rope, and the poor guy plummets to his death, right? In this instance, intention is to save the group, right? The activity is cutting the rope. The good effect is that the weight is lessened. The crew is saved. The evil effect is, the rock climber plummets to his death. But your intention is protected here precisely because the people are saved, not because the man falls to his death. If he falls 100 feet and lands on a cliff and survives, albeit very, very damaged, you know, a lot of broken bones, they're still saved, you see. So the evil effect cannot be what brings about the good effect. Now, with all that inside, in our minds, let's turn to our topic at hand. First, we have an obligation to preserve life. This is our primary obligation. It stands against suicide. It stands against euthanasia. This is a fundamental precept of natural law. It's one of the reasons we are hardwired to do this. It's one of the reasons we are so confused, stunned, whenever we see somebody commit suicide. Regardless of what the culture says, and the culture can, in fact, blind people to these basic precepts of natural law, and can somehow get them confused, St. Thomas is very optimistic that this is still hardwired in, that people have a fundamental inclination to preserve at least their own lives, the lives of the ones they love. So there is no obligation, however, to precariously prolong life. And this is our stance against what we might call vitalism. However, I do want to say with this word vitalism, you have to be careful. This is one of the words you probably don't want to use in mixed company. Because in recent literature in bioethics and in medical ethics, vitalism has pretty much lost all meaning. For us, vitalism is the idea that any and all medical means must be used even when death is imminent and inevitable. In some ways, it can be argued, and it has been argued, that the so-called death with dignity movement began in the 1970s as palliative care, as medical care really started to take off in its technology, and many people had to visit their loved ones for whom death was imminent, but who were nonetheless hooked up to many machines and wires and tubes. And so there was a reaction, an understandable reaction, to this overuse of technology to maintain life even when death was very much imminent and irreversible and inevitable. However, today, vitalism is often used by secular clinicians and secular ethicists to refer to the calculus that suggests that any means that are expensive, any means which medically seem not to have any benefit, that when you have patients or groups or us, the church, pastors, insisting that these means are still obligatory, you might be accused of being a vitalist. So it's important to understand that what we understand by vitalism is a true futility, like standing against the true futility of treatments when death is imminent and inevitable. So it's becoming less of a useful term, but it's important to know it for our own sake. The other thing to note is that there's a distinction, that we should always note a distinction between care and what we might call medical treatment. This distinction came to the fore during the Terri Schiavo incident case, was this about 15 years ago already? 20 years ago? And when St. John Paul II, during one of his discourses, actually highlighted this distinction. So that care is simply what's required because of one's dignity as a human person, being clothed, being bathed, being turned over in a bed when you're unable to turn yourself over, at being fed, being nourished, giving water, just care, basic human care, versus treatment, which is really a medicament. It's really some sort of prescription involved. It is a medicine. It is a care. The other thing to note is when we talk about, and we've all learned these terms, ordinary and extraordinary means, right? The other thing to note is that doctors and nurses, clinicians, mean something very different by those words than what you and I mean by it. In fact, the distinction is so pronounced, I would recommend that when you're in a hospital, when you're talking, in the presence of clinicians, when you're talking to your people, that you don't use the words ordinary and extraordinary means. Because it means something different for the other people, your patients, your parishioners are talking to, the doctors. For a doctor, the medical use of ordinary means, those standard medical treatments that are recognized, that they're established at the level of medical practice, they're approved within the limits of availability, whereas extraordinary would be something like a medicament that is fanciful, it's bizarre, it might be experimental, that might be an experimental drug that's approved for human trials, that seems might be unorthodox, it might be unrecognized. So it spans the whole gamut. So it's important not to use that phraseology. For us, we know, though, that the distinction between ordinary and extraordinary, between, better to say, proportionate or disproportionate or obligatory or optional, this is a moral decision and not a medical decision. This is a moral decision that is taken after one has received counsel and proper information from the doctors and from the clinicians. This is from the Ethic and Religious Directives for Catholic Healthcare Service, the 5th edition in 2009. This document is approved by the Holy See. I'm not going to read this to you. I just simply want to point out these points, that proportionate, and I might would say obligatory means that a person has a moral obligation to use are those that in the judgment of the patient, or proxy, you might say, offer a reasonable hope of benefit, and do not entail an excessive burden or impose an excessive expense on the family or the community. Extraordinary, disproportionate, optional would be just the reverse. So there is, for lack of a better term, a calculus involved here, a prudential calculus, if you will. There's not a set list, right? That's one thing I walk into all the time with patients and with Catholics who are talking to me about this, is that they think that there is a defined list. A ventilator is always extraordinary. You know, feeding tube is always ordinary. Well, no, I'm sorry, there's not. What you run into now especially, you probably have run into this, is people who say that they want their advanced directives or they want their living wills, what have you, please don't hook me up to a ventilator. Please don't put a feeding tube in me. Because they presume, there's a presumption that once you start something, you can't stop it. Right? I mean, how many of you heard that? You know, if you put a feeding tube in me, the church says you can't take it out. And then I'll just endure in that state. Here's the distinction. The question that we are weighing morally is the benefit of the treatment to the person's life, not the benefit of the person or the quality of the person's life. We're weighing, does this treatment in relation, weighed against its burdens, which could be psychological, which could be physical, which could be expense, availability, is this treatment, when I weigh that as a patient or as someone responsible for making these decisions, after I've spoken to the clinicians, is this an adequate trade-off for what reasonably can be expected for this treatment to do for the patient, for me, or for who I'm making decisions for? So the question is benefit to life versus the burden of the treatment. Pope John Paul II said that the attitude is shameful and utterly reprehensible, which presumes to measure the value of human life only within the parameters of normality and physical well-being, thus opening the way to legitimizing infanticide and euthanasia. But the question is never, and should never be for us, about what this person or what an ideal normal life should be. This is true for all suffering. Right? Who lives a normal life, in a sense? Right? We're all sort of on a scale of normality, of what we think might be an ideal normality. These treatments are a sliding scale because what may be ordinary at one point in the history of a pathology or a condition may become extraordinary later, right? So for the high school football captain who gets into an accident, needs a ventilator, the ventilator is probably going to be ordinary at that time. We'd have to look at other situations, other variables there, but it's probably going to be ordinary. You know, but if he needs it and he recovers and they remove it, he's fine. Ordinary means. But if he progresses and then later there's found to be severe damage and it's irrecoverable and then, you know, we move into questions of brain damage, well then, you know, the ventilator may move from ordinary to extraordinary. So it is a sliding scale. It's a sliding scale. So the measure, once again, is the intrinsic benefit of the treatment for the patient's life. Is it effective in relation to its burden? It's an interesting thing that St. John Paul II said is that expense should not be considered primary. Now, you got to take that somewhat with prudence. And of course, you know, in our country with these discussions of healthcare and access to healthcare, which I'm not competent to get into here, I don't have time and I am truly not competent to try to figure out the insurance problems of our country. I don't think Washington can either. They're not competent either on the matter. But considerations, St. John said, about the quality of life are often actually dictated by psychological, social, and economic pressures cannot take precedence over general principles. No evaluation of cost can outweigh the value of the fundamental good which we are trying to protect, that of human life. That doesn't mean the expense is not important. Right? This is the other thing where prudence comes into play. Sometimes in the seminary, or when you're training lay people or talking to lay people, they'll say to you, well, you know, they don't have ventilators in Africa. So how can you make that obligatory? Well, you're not in Africa. right? You're in the United States of America, and we have ventilators readily available if you need it, right? So this is not something that is across the board. A ventilator may be extraordinary in certain remote reaches of the world, simply because of expense and lack of availability. Now let's turn quickly to euthanasia. By euthanasia, and this is the never old, never age, you know, which is aged quite well, the 1980 Declaration of Euthanasia by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. By euthanasia is understood an action or an omission which of itself or by intention causes death in order that all suffering may in this way be eliminated. Euthanasia's terms of reference, therefore, are to be found in the intention of the will and in the methods used. So we would want to make all sorts of distinctions here, that euthanasia can either be an active killing or it can be passive by omitting, starving someone to death. Sometimes euthanasia is voluntary. We see that increasingly, and this is what the so-called death with dignity is about, assisted suicide. It's a voluntary euthanasia. Sometimes it's involuntary. We see this increasingly in Holland. Netherlands, which has had euthanasia for much longer than we have. And sometimes it's non-voluntary when you have a patient who is unable to choose, period. Say a patient, which recently happened in the UK, a patient with mental illness, dementia, who was in fact euthanized, right? Unable to choose to do so. So going back to our chart here, what euthanasia is, the deeper intention, just by this basic sense, is to eliminate suffering. But to eliminate suffering, and that's the further end down there, to eliminate suffering, you can't simply do that without another intention in euthanasia, which is to cause death, the action by some action or omission, which causes then the patient to die, and that becomes then the means to the further end, okay, which is the patient's suffering is no longer suffering. Right? Remember, Robin Hood may be a philanthropist, but he's still a thief. Right? The motivating factor, the deeper intention of euthanasia, who knows? It may be motivated by compassion. Maybe it's motivated by selfishness or pride. But let's say it's motivated by compassion. It's important to say that those who turn to euthanasia, they might be more compassionate. They might be more self-giving. They don't want to be a burden on their family. That might be their true deeper intention. But they're still murderers, and they're still committing suicide. They might be more deeply compassionate, more deeply self-offering, but they're still murderers, or they're still committing suicide. An erroneous judgment on this does not change the matter. The error of judgment, especially on euthanasia, this is from the Catechism, into which one can fall in good faith, does not change the nature of the murderous act, which must always be forbidden and excluded. Now, this is distinguished from allowing someone to die when death is imminent and inevitable. It is permitted in conscience to take the decision to refuse forms of treatment that would only secure a precarious and burdensome prolongation of life, so long as the normal care due to the sick person in similar cases is not interrupted. The key here is you cannot intend for the person to die. You accept the inevitable. And you see it, foresee it. You cannot intend the person to die, and you cannot be, through your action or omission, you cannot be the intentional agent of death. It has to be the pathology, it has to be the condition, something flowing from the condition that is the cause of death, right? The cancer, the inability to process food anymore, for the body to process food. Right? Hastening death is a similar thing. Patients should be kept as free of pain as possible so that they may die comfortably and with dignity, interesting use of the word there, and in the place where they wish to die. Since a person has the right to prepare for his or her death while fully conscious, he or she should not be deprived of consciousness without a compelling reason. Medicines capable of alleviating and suppressing pain may be given to a dying person, even if this therapy may indirectly shorten a person's life, so long as the intent is not to hasten death. So that's the double effect, right? So to alleviate pain, to give the medicine, to give the medicine so that pain subsides and death, even though death may be hastened. Last evening, Father Romano Cesario spoke about advanced directives. I want to recommend that you take a look at the advanced directives form that the National Catholic Bioethics Center has produced. It produced it a number of years ago. It lays out all of this. I highly recommend it. We used it for my own parents who have now gone to God, but it's detailed enough to be clear that the moral tradition of the church is going to be followed in decisions about one's end-of-life care, including the decisions, including the choices. I'd like to be conscious as much as possible so that I might prepare well for my death, and I'd like to be anointed by a priest, you know, and to have my confession heard if that is possible at the time. When my mother was in the last month of her life, and I gave that both to a nursing home, that they had never seen anything like it, of course, right? So, her son's a priest, so this is what happens. Right? It was an interesting thing. My sister had to be the primary care, but it was written such that she had to have me interpret what all of this meant before she made a decision about doing anything. It worked out quite well. In principle, this is from the healthcare directives again. In principle, there is an obligation to provide patients with food and water, including medically assisted nutrition and hydration for those who cannot take food orally. This is true even for comatose patients. This comes from the 2004 address on life-sustaining treatments that John Paul Kane gave not long after or during the Terry Schiavo episodes. So this is, in fact, about, 13 years ago. The thing to note that on the administration of water and food is this little clause at the end. It's morally obligatory insofar and until it is seen to have attained its proper finality, which in the present consists, that's a typo there, but which in the present consists in providing nourishment to the patient and alleviation of his suffering. So the proper finality of artificial nutrition and hydration is to hydrate and to nourish until it becomes, which it can, a source of suffering itself. So as a patient proceeds towards closer to death, there might be concerns about infections of the port, you know, and that this port has to constantly be moved and cleaned. There might be concerns that the body eventually ceases to be able to absorb the nutrients and the water. There's also concerns about asphyxiation as a person gets closer to death. In those cases, to insist that, you got to keep the tube in, would be to misunderstand this prudential calculus, if you will. There's no longer, at that point, the burden of even artificial nutrition hydration outweighs the benefit to the patient. There are contrary voices in our society about all of this. This is Brittany Maynard. You all probably know this story. Brittany was diagnosed with stage 4 brain cancer when she was 29 years old in 2014. The prognosis at the time was that she was given 6 months to live. She was married, she was a teacher, she was a traveler, world traveler, a rock climber. Now, this one bullet point, she was obviously much more than that, but this is what the media always pointed out about her. These were the characteristics that were always called forth when describing her. She moved from California to Oregon so that she could have death with dignity. And on November 1st, 2014, in an undisclosed, prescribed way, she chose to die. And so that is the date of her death. Per Oregon state law, the cause of death on her certificate is brain cancer. She didn't die from brain cancer. She died from the drugs or the methods that were prescribed for her in Oregon to die from. This is a lie. It's an insidious lie. Right. Brittany Maynard was a sort of poster child, if you will, for Compassion and Choices, which is the premier political action committee organization that is promoting assisted suicide throughout the United States. Right now, there are 6 states in which assisted suicide is legal, and now the District of Columbia, that's also legal. There are 30 states that Compassion and Choices are currently working at the ground level, at the grassroots level, to get assisted suicide onto a ballot and into a referendum vote. 30 states. This is not going away. Brittany Maynard, with the money and the sort of pull of Compassion and Choices, was able to sort of spread this concept of death with dignity. She was young, attractive, and with the money and the media blitz, the Compassion and Choices, which was, by the way, formerly known as the Hemlock Society, doesn't really go over anymore as Hemlock Society, they pushed her into the media. She was everywhere. Her cause was the cause du jour while she was alive. Of course, Compassion and Choices needed the help of other people. They need a spokesman of faith. And so they turned to this man. Yes. In October of 2014, the month before she died, Episcopalian Bishop Jean Robinson wrote an article for Daily Beast titled, On Her Own Terms, Why Brittany Maynard Has Chosen to Die. Here are some of the things he said. This strong and rugged woman of the outdoors decided she would take charge of her death like she had taken charge of her life. Perhaps more than anything, what people fear most, aside from the pain of a terminal illness, is a loss of control. Call it pride and the desire over autonomy, autonomy over one's life, if you will. But to those who advocate for the right to end one's life, it is the right to die with dignity. I think she deserves that right, and I think it is a thoroughly moral choice. There is nothing innately redemptive about pain. This is a Christian, a self-identified Christian. There is nothing innately good about allowing nature to take its course in a prolonged and painful journey to an inevitable death. It doesn't make you a better person because you endured the indignity and trauma of it. You don't get extra stars for it. In my church's baptismal covenant, we promise to respect the dignity of every human being. That is all Brittany is asking, that we, society, respect her dignity and allow her to end her life before her dignity is stripped from her, little by little, until there is little left of it. You see the point here? Dignity is self-expression. It's choice. On November 1st, when Brittany ends her short, productive life, I will be thanking God for her remarkable and courageous example. This is really the problem that we're up against, the commercialization of human life. And it's happened rather quickly in the last 50 or 60 years. People magazine, in its cover story on Brittany, had noted, quote, for the past 29 years, Brittany Maynard has lived a fearless life, running half marathons, traveling through Southeast Asia for a year, and even climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. So it's no surprise she is facing her death the same way. It's been astutely noted that the same magazine, People, some 24 years earlier, when the actor Michael Landon of Little House on the Prairie fame, Highway to Heaven, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, People magazine, as well as the rest of the popular media, praised his courage for not taking his own life and for suffering publicly and for enduring what he had to endure, for being courageous to the end. Increasingly, what we're finding in hospitals and in medical care and in the conversation in the public square is that futility is becoming a concern, not the futility of particular treatments, but the futility of life that is preserved, of life being preserved. In this month before Brittany Maynard died, I was invited by Sister Maureen Fielder, who some of you may know that name, to be on her radio program, Interfaith Voices. She also invited Bishop Jean Robinson. I don't think he quite knew what he was getting into. And so we were in the studio discussing these matters. I will say I'm somewhat proud of by the fact of that at the end of the radio program, he felt the need to reassert that he was, in fact, Christian. and just as much of a disciple of Jesus Christ as myself. I said to him that it didn't show. they didn't air that part. On the face of it, though, of course, in some ways he's probably right, Gene Robinson, that suffering is not inherently good. It's not self-evident that it's good. If it were, we wouldn't have to be having these kinds of conversations. It's naturally something that we flee. And I know Father O'Donnell tomorrow will speak a little bit more about how we as priests interact with suffering Christians. But I must say that although Gene Robinson is right about that, I was stunned that a man who identifies as both a disciple of Christ and as an ordained minister in his own tradition would insist that there's nothing redemptive about suffering. I mean, it's one thing to speak on a human level that suffering has no value, but to claim as a man of faith that suffering is not redemptive is in some ways to deny the very foundational truth of Christianity, that our redemption was wrought precisely by the suffering of the Son of God and his humanity. I was surprised by the position because, quite honestly, that truth that you and I are redeemed by the suffering of Jesus Christ seems to me to be the only satisfying answer to the means of suffering. Robinson is wrong. He's insidiously in error. To promote what Benedict XVI and what modern clinicians and what modern secular progressivism is promoting, what he referred to as the Promethean vision of man, what Pope Francis has called a technocratic mentality that sees life in quantifiable terms of actualization and accomplishment. Now, the good news, brothers, is that it's not our task to systematically turn civilization around, to strategize some winning political solution. That would be to give in to the same technocracy that we're fighting. As priests, ours is the task, it seems to me, to shepherd souls and to build up our people and to keep them on the path to Jesus Christ, a path that necessarily passes by way of the cross and by suffering. I think the difficulty that we all run into, and I'm going to put a plug in for the breakout sessions here in a minute, that we run into when we're talking with those who suffer incredibly, people who really suffer incredibly over prolonged periods of time, is that we must be ready to admit that there are no easy answers to why people must suffer. And we must pray for pastoral prudence on how to do that. How do we translate the great theological mysteries of God's providence and suffering, how do we translate that God always works for the good of those who love him, that suffering is redemptive? All of that can't be easily done. In his 1984 letter on suffering, Salvifici Doloris, John Paul II recognized that there are no easy answers. He has these beautiful few paragraphs in that letter where he talks about the answer of suffering is often only known individually to the one who suffers, who meets Christ in a new way. And even then, often only after the fact, looking back and how the suffering brought conversion, brought hope. I would say when we talk about these things in life decisions, we must always be careful that we know who we're talking to, the clinicians, but most especially that you know your parishioners, you know the people that you're helping to counsel, you know what they can handle, what they can see. Hopefully you know where they are, generally speaking, in their life of faith. How much truth can they tolerate at this particular moment? So that we can present the gospel in its fullness and pray that the Holy Spirit would move them to always be faithful, to make even the courageous choices, the courageous choice not to give up their life, but to endure the suffering that will bring them sanctification and holiness and give honor to the Creator who has given them life and who remains the Lord of life until the end. Thank you.
Absolutely.
It's gotten a little hidden on their website. I wish maybe Father Nicanor can tell us exactly if he knows where exactly it is on the website. They still have it, so you'd have to Google it. But what I can do is maybe if I can email a link to Father Austin and then he can email it to all of you. I think it's very helpful. It's very good.
My question is related, and I guess more generally, as we're preaching these things, not necessarily in the moment or the company that a suffering person, but in general in our parish, what's your prudential take on the current situation in terms of how, for lack of a better word, antagonistic we need to be against not just general culture, but the specific advice and perspective they might be receiving from their doctors in the hospital?
I think one of the things, and obviously this is all prudential, and I'm just going to preface my answer by saying that, I think you're right. We have to acknowledge the fact that the parishioners in the pews are drinking the water, so to speak, of the Death with Dignity movement. It's very logical. It's very understandable. Okay, nobody wants to suffer. Nobody wants to endure prolonged illness. Nobody wants to be a burden on their family. I think what we heard yesterday from Father Romano Cesario and Father Paul Keller, I think some of those points are very important to understand, which is, I'm looking at Father Paul Keller's talk last night, how important it is to understand the configuration that the suffering person has to the suffering Christ. I hope I'm not mischaracterizing your talk, Father. And so to preach that, right, and to build up those in your parish who are homebound or suffering, to make them help them to understand that they continue not only to be called to sanctification, but in some ways they play a role still in the community of the church, right? In the sense that they become witnesses of the suffering Christ. Now, as far as moving individuals, I think in that it's much easier to begin to talk to people about the fact that, and this is where the culture is actually helpful to us, that doctors aren't perfect. Right? One of the challenges I know that doctors face is this increasing sense that it's nothing special to be a doctor, and patients tend to see doctors, and I mean, it's a problem on one hand, but for our purposes, it could actually be helpful in the sense that people see their relationship with their doctors as dispenser of medical treatment, and there's not a person-to-person relationship. So to help people to understand and balance what some parishioners, some especially an older generation, might see everything a doctor says and take it for the gospel. A younger generation might say, oh no, I need to get second opinions. But to be a dissenting voice is what I would say in people's lives, right? To be a dissenting voice on this, to say that no, life is inherently good. Your life has inherent meaning. It's valuable. It's good, even though you might be suffering. And in some ways, as a Christian, we would say you're actually more proximate and closer to Jesus Christ when you are. I realize I might have rambled there, but that's probably the best I can do. Okay, well, it looks like I've stunned them into silence. Not the first time. Thank you so much, my brothers. Thank you.